Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today, we're going to get into the weeds on the subject of coma. Comatose patient, unresponsive in the ED or ICU. We're going to be talking with Ilko Wadix, MD, PhD, neurointensivist at the Mayo. He is the editor of the Neurocritical Care Journal. He is a monster when it comes to publishing on neurocritical care topics, and I met him through the Neurocritical Care Society when we were working on the ENLS course, and he is brilliant. And one of his areas of interest is coma. So you're going to love this. Before we get there, I want to say we've just graduated a couple of people from the Resus Leadership Academy. So we have two open slots. They're going to go incredibly quickly. If you haven't heard about the RLA before, this is essentially a Resus fellowship that doesn't require you to take a year off from your life. We do it by professor discussions through online teleconferencing. We do it through lectures. And essentially, I guarantee after that year, you will go from whatever level of resuscitation you are now to being the top, the best in your program, in your center. This course will change your career in emergency medicine, critical care, hospitalist, et cetera. And so go to mcrit.org/RLA, and ask for more information. We'll send it out to you. It's not cheap. I don't even know how expensive it is, but it is expensive, but game-changing and a lot cheaper than taking a year off and doing a real resuscitation fellowship. Okay, back to coma. Like I say, Ilko and I are going to get in the weeds on some questions I had, questions I want answers to. You probably, if you're at the nascent stages of your career, have more basic questions. Send them to me or put them in the comments at mcrit.org/186, and I'll do an episode on the basics of diagnosis and management of coma based on the answers you give. And I have some great review articles already up on the site, but I will go through the basics because this is a more advanced talk. All right, let's get to it. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about yourself?
My name is Ilko Wadix. I'm a neurointensivist at Mayo Clinic. Been here for about 25 years.
I first came across you in the Neurocritical Care Society when we were working on the ENLS course, the Emergency Neurological Life Support course. But even if I didn't meet you there, I would have come across you because of the topic we're discussing today, coma, because I've read all your articles on it. And then recently I picked up the second edition of your book on coma. And I would say before your book, I would have recommended Plum and Posner as the one to read, and now I don't need to anymore because I have something modern. What led you to write a book on coma, Ilko?
Well, for the simple reason is that there had to be a more modern approach to the exam and management of coma. And Paul and Posner's book is largely focused on diagnostics and not so much on management. So that was the main reason to revisit this topic.
You mentioned a few of the things I want to talk about. The first one is on diagnosis, and I guess the first part of diagnosis is the exam. How do you change your standard neurological exam for a patient in coma?
Well, in general, I think the fundamentals, when a patient who comes to the emergency room who is acutely comatose remains a series of important questions that will have to be asked by the neurologist and the emergency physician, and that is a coma due to a destructive structural brain lesion, or is it due to a global acute physiological derangement of brain function? And if there is a structural lesion on both hemispheres, or is it in the brainstem? And then the next question is, if it is in the brainstem, is it inside the brainstem or due to displacement of the brainstem? So these simple questions will have to be asked before you start examining the patient. I think most emergency room physicians, when a patient comes in and the patient has been stabilized, will get to a CT scan. And then the problem starts when the CT scan does not show an explanation for why the patient is comatose. So I thought that it would be best to look at two things. First is to use major components of the neurologic examination that would localize where the lesion is, and then differentiate between patients who have an abnormal CT scan and do have a normal CT scan. So the approach is basically, if you see a patient with acute comatose, the first thing to look at is, and then assuming that there are no confounders, most neurologists don't like it if the patient has just been intubated and we have no real good cause. For obvious reasons, we lose as much of this of the neurologic examination. But if that's necessary, so be it. So if we can examine the patient's motor response, then and if there is, and let's go talk about the worst motor responses, the decortic and decerebrate motor response or no motor response, the next step is to look at the brainstem and see if there's a fixed dilated pupil or if there is an anisochoria or skew deviation or if other brainstem reflexes are abnormal, because that determines, in the first case, when there's a fixed dilated pupil, there's an acute hemispheric lesion, which should be seen on CT scan, and if there is not, and there's anisochoria or skew deviation, or the brainstem reflexes are abnormal, you get into an acute brainstem lesion. And if the CT scan is normal, that implies that there has to be an embolus to the basilar artery, which would require a CTA. So those are terribly important, essential findings initially that could help us in trying to determine why this has happened. Now, if there is a decorticate or a decerebrate or no motor response and their brainstem reflexes are completely normal, you can safely assume that it's a bihemispheric lesion. It's not terribly important to know whether it's due to a thalamic lesion or due to cortical lesion. And then the next differentiation is, okay, there's a bihemispheric lesion. Is it structural or is it physiological? And when it's structural, you can further differentiate. Is it cortex? Is it white matter? Is it an acute hydrocephalus? Is there brain edema? Has there been an infection or a subarachnoid hemorrhage? All can be seen on a CT scan. Now, the CT scan is not perfect because a normal CT scan can still show a very abnormal MRI scan, and we know that in patients who have had significant traumatic head injury that that only will just fake findings on CT scan and will be found on MRI scan. Anoxic injury cannot be found on a CT scan initially. Fat embolization or an encephalitis and even a meningitis. And then the most common, one of the most common findings of becoming stupors in the emergency department in patients hypertensive is PRESS or any other toxic leukoencephalopathy cannot be seen on a CT scan. So the patient can be comatose from all these reasons, while the MRI scan can be very diagnostic. And I would say do not underuse an MRI scan if there's really uncertainty. I would just go for it and try to convince the radiologist to get that MRI scan if you still are confused. Now, if there's a physiological finding, a physiological reason, what I meant with that is that there's a toxin or the patient has alcohol intoxication or has been seizing or there has been an acute metabolic derangement or perhaps even an environmental exposure, each of these abnormalities can be found by specific laboratory abnormalities. So this gives you some sort of a framework of how to approach it rather than start with an enormous differential diagnosis and not knowing where to start.
Okay, so let's break that down just a little bit. So if you have this patient with a normal CT, because if there's an abnormal CT, we generally know what to do with these patients. A normal CT, but they have anisochoria or a concerning motor exam, you're worried about a basilar artery lesion and they should get a CT angiogram. Is that correct so far?
Yes, I think that's in the acute stage, one of the most important acute situations that will have to be recognized and can be treated. Those patients would need an endovascular retrieval of a clot and can be salvaged immediately. But that should be recognized by carefully examining the brainstem reflex and carefully looking at pupils. Just saying the pupils are fixed or the pupils even normal pupils can be anisochoric, or they look normal, but they can be anisochoric or there can be a skew deviation. So it's important to specifically look at those findings on your examination that could point you into that direction.
But if they don't have worrisome pupillary findings or brainstem abnormalities, and they do not have either posturing or the complete absence of a motor exam, so for instance, they're withdrawing to pain or doing something that doesn't put them in that very concerning motor category, now you start worrying that you either have a structural or physiological bihemispheric lesion. And one of the things that could really help you is the ability to get an MRI. Which sequences would you do, and would you do that without contrast, Ilko, or is there any benefit to having contrast on that MRI?
I would use gadolinium enhancement, particularly if there's a meningitis, you can see it. And in some toxic encephalopathies, it's good to look at that. But in general, gadolinium addition is not terribly essential. I think just a regular MRI scan with diffusion-weighted images would be important.
Okay. Let's say you're at a place where getting an MRI is just impossible. Is a CTA in perfusion in these patients who don't have the worrisome signs of a basal or artery injury still helpful if you can't get an MRI?
Not necessarily, I would think. I think in the overwhelming proportion, the CT scan will help you. It's more what do you do when the CT scan is normal and the patient's comatose and you have no good explanation for it. Your initial laboratory is normal. Those are the ones that we're mostly concerned about. A CT scan, an MRI scan should be considered, and perhaps the patient should go to an institution where an MRI scan can be done if there's no other good explanation for it when you have the chance to get an adequate history, because we're talking here about the examination, and the examination should possibly only proceed if we have a good idea of what has happened to the patient. So there are many questions that will have to be asked to family members or bystanders. Where was this patient found? What were the circumstances that the patient were found in, et cetera, et cetera.
Very good. Who should we tap, Ilko? Who gets a lumbar puncture?
I think there should be a low threshold, and I think anyone in which there is a prior history of fever or confusion or focal findings that have been transient or such as in a herpes simplex encephalitis, a patient who has been aphasic or had difficulty speaking, those patients would need to be tapped. And obviously the one that is at high propensity of a meningitis are patients who are alcoholics or are malnourished. I would probably proceed with that after a CT scan is done. I would probably have a low threshold, and there's obviously also laboratory abnormalities that can point you to that direction. But if you have no explanation and the patient has been febrile, and there's been also a history of that would suggest there's an infection, I would tap the patient.
Would you send it for all of the encephalopathy panel labs at this point, or would you wait to see the results of your cell count to be showing you something indicative?
I would probably send it for herpes simplex PCRs, and of course there's a seasonality to it. If the patient is seen in the summer, I would look at West Nile and do PCRs in West Nile and other arboviruses. I think that's probably the safest way to do that, rather than just have to go back and find and do a PCR. So it depends on the time that you see the patient, the season that you see the patient, and the presentation. So as we now know, is that a large proportion of patients with encephalitis now are now known to have an autoimmune encephalitis, and so antibodies are necessary to the Valtis channel antibodies, and the NMDA antibodies are important to get in the CSF to exclude or diagnose these types of encephalitis. So that's equally important.
Now, a situation we commonly run into is a patient who is febrile, maybe they're elderly, and we just want to attribute it to sepsis encephalitis, but maybe they just have a very cheap urinalysis. It's not flagrantly urosepsis. Do we have to tap those patients? And if so, how do you differentiate who you're going to tap when you do think it is sepsis encephalitis, but you really want to differentiate it from meningitis?
Yeah, so I think for many emergency physicians, it's known that I think the first thing to think about, and that I'm sure most emergency room physicians think about, is that a patient who's septic and has neurologic findings, that we would have to look for a possible neurologic source for sepsis. So a patient with severe meningitis or with an epidural abscess could present with sepsis. So I would probably just go into that direction. If someone presents with sepsis, I would, and there's evidence of central nervous system findings or spinal cord findings, I would probably go into that direction to find if that would not be the source of sepsis.
All right. Who gets an EEG? Who gets ruled out for non-convulsive status?
I would think anybody that has seized to say, well, we have no good explanation for anything, let's get an EEG in that patient. Might be useful, but many EEGs are abnormal if the patient is comatose, and some of these abnormalities can be misread as non-convulsive status epilepticus, and non-convulsive status epilepticus is extremely uncommon in the emergency department. So only if there has been a history of seizures or the patient has had seizures, I would probably proceed with an EEG in the emergency department. I would think that probably is the best advice.
Why don't we finish up, Ilko, with something you mentioned at the top of the show, which is you created a new neurologic scale for coma patients to replace the GCS called the 4-score. Tell us about this and convince us why we should switch over.
So, coma in general has been communicated through the Glasgow Coma Scale, and it seems that everybody now throws around some scores, GCS of 8 or 3 or 14 or 13, and it seems that the word coma has been really been replaced by this sum score, and that is a concern. At least in my experience, very few physicians who really spell out what they mean with this Glasgow Coma Score. So we wanted to go back and look at the bare necessities of a coma examination and look what would be important to know and what would force physicians to look at when they use this score. The 4-score stands for four components that will have to be tested: eye responses, motor responses, brainstem reflexes, and respiration. And each of these components have four as a maximal score. The eye responses measure eye opening and eye movements. You don't get eye movements with the Glasgow Coma Score. Motor movements include complex commands that you don't get with the Glasgow Coma Score. Brainstem reflexes are not tested. We test pupil, corneal, and cuff reflexes, and respiration is absolutely not looked at in Glasgow Coma Score. While it is such an important part of your neurologic examination, when patients become drowsy, their respiratory rhythm changes, and when the patient is intubated, it's important to know if they have a respiratory drive on their mechanical ventilator. So it provides a lot more information in a patient who presents. It allows you to recognize a locked-in syndrome by having the patient look up and look down, as well as other coma states that are far better examined when these simple tests are done, rather than just a Glasgow Coma Score. The problem with the Glasgow Coma Score, and particularly in the emergency department, is the patients are intubated, losing the verbal component. Patients may have facial trauma using eye-opening component. So you basically have only the motor component left. And in the 4-score, many of the pupil assessments remain unaffected by any degree of sedation, and therefore really contributes to your examination. Basically, it really forces physicians to look at a patient looking at these individual components.
I love it. And it actually, what you just said is why I love it so much, is because when I ask you what exam should we be doing on a coma patient, if you actually perform the 4-score, it's going to force you to do almost all of the things you should examine, while the GCS really doesn't prompt you at all to do a proper exam on a coma patient. What's the best way, Ilko, for people to learn and be able to educate the other people in their department on the 4-score?
The best way is to look at publications on the 4-score, and there are many of them. We at Mayo have cards that we can provide.
And we'll put those in the show notes.
my coma book has a video, an instructional video on the fourscore, and explains how to perform it. But most of us know how to do this. In fact, when emergency room physicians are compared to neurologists in an inter-observer variability test, things look pretty good, and the scores are very high.
Fantastic. I guess we'll finish up with one last question, which is, you actually wrote an article, and we'll put it in the show notes, on why you still need a neurologist in the ICU for a patient with coma. So I guess the question is, if you had a patient with coma with a normal head CT, should we be consulting neurology and getting them involved early on these patients?
I would hope so. I would hope that when a patient comes in the emergency department that is unclear, and there's confusion, that the neurologist or the neurointensivist, together with the emergency department, emergency physician, would be able to sort out how to best diagnose and help the patient.
We can't thank you enough for coming on, Ilko, and I know people are going to get a lot out of listening to this episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, there you go. As I mentioned, I'll do an episode on the basics of coma diagnosis and management. So if you have questions, put them in the comments. And remember, we have two slots now for the Resus Leadership Academy. So go to mcrit.org/RLA or just Google Resus Leadership Academy and make sure when you ask for more information that you say mcrit referred you. Scott Weingart for the mcrit podcast saying bye-bye.